It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Janine Garofalo's favorite tea-bagging redneck, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am your host, Mark Gillar. Our guest today is Jane Hampton Cook. She is the former webmaster for George W. Bush. That put her in charge of both WhiteHouse.gov and WhiteHouseKids.gov. She is the author of Battlefields and Blessings, Stories of Faith and Courage from the Revolutionary War, as well as The Faith of America's First Ladies, and B is for Baylor. Neil Cavuto of Fox refers to her as a presidential historian extraordinaire. Jane, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I can't help but feel that over the last few decades that history has been essentially rewritten by liberals in the world of academia who want to scrub any mention of God or faith out of the history books, but faith was incredibly important to our founding fathers. And I know you've said that you're a big fan of David Barton. Is there anything in the First Amendment that you can think of that would require that we scrub any mention of God or faith from our textbooks?
Well, you know, certainly not. I mean, the founders did not prescribe religion when they were establishing our country, but they fully expected freedom of religion to flourish. And I think that that's really the key, is that people of faith have the right to worship and to express themselves and talk about their beliefs in God. And I don't think you can exclude that from history, because it's a part of people's lives throughout history. And so it's important to look at it, and to look at it from how did it affect people, and especially when you see crisis after crisis in our country, oftentimes people would turn to God and faith for answers. So it's just really a part of human history that's very critical to who we are as human beings.
But as a historian, is it hard for you to look at a lot of the contemporary history books and see that there is virtually no mention of faith, the faith of our founding fathers, in those books?
Well, you know, I really don't look at modern history books for that very reason, because what I think is important is to go back to the original sources, to read the letters of Washington, to read what, you know, even Benjamin Franklin said, and he talked a lot about the Proverbs in his writings as a young man. That meant a lot to him, those Proverbs, because they developed his work ethic. It was something his father taught him. So I think it's important to look at the original sources and what did people have to say about their own lives. And that's what I try to do. I don't really look at modern textbooks. I try to go back to the letters and diaries and original source material, because I think it's much closer to what really happened.
Do you think there's a need on the part of conservatives, on the part of Tea Partiers, to try to retake the classrooms? Because it would seem that liberals pretty much dominate from kindergarten through grad school in terms of getting their version of history out there.
Well, you know, I think there's definitely a slant to that direction. And I think that, you know, one thing that's really great about the Tea Party movement is that there is a focus on what really did happen. And there's a hunger to really learn about the lives of our founders and to learn about people in our heritage and to look at them as individuals and look at individual liberty and what that meant. And I think that the more you point back to what really happened in the original source material, I think the more that will eventually permeate throughout families' lives and into the educational process, because you really can't dispute what George Washington said about his own life. And you can try, but the evidence is there that he really profoundly believed in Providence, and that Providence was not, it wasn't just good luck as it means today. It meant back then, according to the pastors and ministers of the day, God's walking with his people. So when Washington talks about Providence, he's looking at God's intervention into the cause of liberty, which he fervently believed was a just cause. And, you know, his words about God were always very respectful. They seemed very formal to us, but back then it was all about respect. And I think, you know, I hope that my writings are helping to put some of that into a fresh context and see to help people see things, hopefully as they were, but also to see them as they are differently presented, you know, by others today, too.
Well, it seems like the left is threatened by the fact that our founding fathers had such strong faith in God, to the point where, as I'm sure you're well aware of, there have been a lot of books written and a lot of articles written suggesting that the faith of our founding fathers was not that strong. You know, this founding father was a deist, this founding father was an atheist, this founding father didn't have that strong a faith. What's your take on the attempt on some from the left to sort of repaint the founding fathers as being a relatively secular group?
Well, I think that they really missed the mark on that because, you know, when I was doing research for Stories of Faith and Courage from the Revolutionary War, I kind of thought I would find a lot of deism because that's sort of what the mainstream thought was. But when I started reading, you know, George Washington's letters back home to his mom while he was a soldier when he was 22 years old, I couldn't help but realize there was not this idea that, this deistic idea that God created the world and abandoned it. I mean, George Washington had a near-death experience on the battlefield, and he gets to Fort Cumberland, Maryland, realizes that he took off his coat and there were bullet holes in through that coat, but he was unhurt. And he wrote his mother a letter to assure her, you know, he said, "I assure you that I now appear and exist in the land of the living by the miraculous care of Providence that protected me beyond all human expectation." And when you see that, you realize, wow, he had this near-death experience and he saw that God was instrumental in preserving his life. And that is an emotional human experience that few people, I think, probably really have at such a young age. And it profoundly affected him. It made him think, why was my life preserved? What greater purpose might there be for me? And I think that when the Continental Army came along and called him to be, you know, commander-in-chief, I think he realized that was his greater purpose. So I think that the evidence is clear and strong that this idea of deism is very, you know, far-fetched and far-afield and I think overstated when you look at the experiences that our founders had.
One of the things I'd like to point out is that in America there are a lot of people, including people who are well-read, who sometimes tend to avoid books that have anything in the title that suggest faith or religion. And as someone myself, who I believe myself to have a very strong relationship with God, but I don't consider myself an overly religious person at times, and I'll be honest with you, I don't often go to churches as much as I should. I went through this book, and for me, and I want to thank you for this, it provided a reawakening of faith, an enhancement of spirituality. And I can tell you that, you know, these little prayers that you put at the end of each story are very moving. There's one in particular on page 429, and it says, "Thank you for the gift of family, for the drive it gives me to live, love, and labor in life." And that's probably one that I need to say every day. And so for someone out there who might see the title and think, "Oh, Battlefield and Blessings, I don't know, that book's not for me." I mean, it really does have something to offer everyone, whether or not you consider yourself, you know, someone who is strongly religious. Does it not have that to offer?
Yeah, I definitely think it does, because for one thing, this book takes you from the beginning to the end of the American Revolution. You know, these were people who were living loudly for liberty. They were foot soldiers, people that you've never heard of, all the way, you know, to John Adams and Jefferson and people that you have distinctly heard of. And it gives you this picture of what the founding of our nation was truly like and the sacrifices that were made. But because it does it in 365 separate stories, you can read it once a day and get a quick look. But there is a prayer and a scripture that accompanies each. And so it can have a life application to your life if you so, you know, choose to look to do that. And, you know, one thing I wanted to include excerpts from some of the sermons from that time period. And I wanted to show what was the same about today, life today, and what was maybe a little bit different about life today and life back then when it came to the issues of faith. And so sometimes you see that the struggles that people had back then, you know, when Benedict Arnold committed treason, a lot of ministers preached on integrity. And, you know, we see that today when a leader falls and drops from integrity, you know, their integrity is gone. We struggle with that issue. Well, why did that happen? Well, they did too back then, back in the, you know, in 1780 and 81. But the other thing that I really wanted to look at was, you know, how did people of faith, people who believed that the king was ordained by God to be their sovereign leader, how did they decide that it was okay to take up arms and fight against that king? And I realized that was a very real struggle for people of faith during the American Revolution. There wasn't a simple answer. It was something they genuinely wrestled with. And I think that's a strong intellectual question as well as a spiritual question that you can really look at and think, huh, well, what was that like for them? And, you know, many people concluded that in a spiritual sense, it was for freedom that Christ came, therefore stand firm for freedom and do not let yourselves be yoked by slavery, which is Galatians 5:1. And a lot of the Christians in that time period saw, hey, there's a spiritual dimension to that, but there's also a practical. If I want my family to have liberty down the road, I need to stand firm for freedom in a political sense and in a governmental sense today. And so those are some questions that this book explores, which a lot of other books, you know, frankly don't. And it's a missing element sometimes to other historians who are looking at the American Revolution.
As I read through some of these stories, one of the things that occurred to me is that there was just this incredible parallel between the sacrifices that these people were making and some of the sacrifices that you see people making today to try to win this country back. And I'm not going to pretend for 1 minute that the sacrifices that the Tea Party is making now begin to compare with these people who were putting their lives on the line, you know, previously. But I can tell you that, well, for instance, I was at a Tea Party last night, a Tea Party organization meeting last night, and, you know, people are giving up time with their family in the evenings. People are putting various aspects of their lives on hold to fight for something that they believe in. And I would say to Tea Partiers out there who are sacrificing time and energy and sweat equity, if you will, at this time to fight for something that they believe in, seeing and reading the words of these people who fought during the American Revolution is very, very inspirational. You know, I mean, my thought is wow, if these people would risk their lives, the least I can do is, you know, give up an evening of watching television or sports to attend a Tea Party organizational meeting, or to, you know, take a Saturday afternoon instead of just relaxing and enjoying leisurely activity, get out somewhere and hold a sign. Did you mean for the book to be inspirational toward the Tea Party movement or toward modern-day conservatives in that way?
Well, I'm really glad it's being seen that way. Now, I wrote it before the Tea Party movement
got started,
but, you know, one thing I wanted to show, and speaking of the Tea Party, the original Tea Party, I didn't realize, you know, I just kind of assumed that the Tea Party, they dumped 350 chests of tea over, you know, over into Boston Harbor, and it was this big demonstration. What I did not realize is that there were so many other forms of protest that the colonists went through before they even got to that point. They were signing petitions, protesting the fact that they had lost their right to a jury trial in Massachusetts. They were issuing proclamations, and they even sent an olive branch petition to the king before it was all said and done. And what I hope this book shows is that there were multiple ways that the colonists expressed their dissatisfaction with the king and the loss of rights as they saw them coming down, lost, they couldn't assemble anymore, they lost their constitution in Massachusetts, all of those things. And that's what I think is great about the Tea Party movement. There are many ways that people are expressing their concerns about our rights and liberties today. And I think that that's what's fascinating, is that there are many things that the colonists did. Yes, they put their lives on the line, but they did a lot more before that, before it culminated in that level of sacrifice, which is why I think the Tea Party is important today, because there are a lot of avenues that we have today that they didn't have back then to express ourselves on a local, state, and a national level.
Are you amazed, as I am, with the vilification of the Tea Party? I mean, despite the fact that there's never been an arrest of a Tea Party member anywhere, despite the fact that millions of people have joined in these rallies, it continues to be portrayed as a very angry, very dangerous, very violent, somewhat racist movement. And what's your take on the way the opposition has attempted to paint the Tea Party?
Well, I think that there are definitely people in the opposition that are trying to paint it that way. But I do think that truth goes a long way. And when the facts are known and the truth is so evident, that will in the long run be the greatest testament to the Tea Party, you know, movement and its activities. Because I just don't think propaganda that is not based in truth will ultimately fall apart at some point. And maybe I'm a little optimistic that way, but that's just my sense, is that when the truth is there, then it will manifest itself in the long run.
I think one of the things we can look to, I guess, make the claim that the left really doesn't know what to do with the Tea Party is that it has changed its attack so many times. I mean, the first thing we heard is that it was AstroTurf, labeled as such by Nancy Pelosi, and that it was really something that was being put together behind the scenes by the big insurance companies and by Fox News and talk radio, and that it was very much an AstroTurf-type movement, not a grassroots movement. And then when that didn't work, we heard that the Tea Party was very racist, then we heard the Tea Party was violent, and it seems like they keep trying to attach these labels, and none of them are sticking.
Right. Well, you know, I think that happened with Ronald Reagan, if I remember correctly, that he was attacked for a lot of different reasons, and they didn't stick. And so there was a kind of a Teflonness about Reagan, and I think when you're in a situation like that, you have to just focus on the goal and the mission and the hope and the optimism that can be ahead. And I think that's what you have to focus on to deflect the arrows.
One of the things I've noticed about Tea Partiers that I bump into at various rallies is that they seem to be incredibly well-read. It's not at all unusual to bump into a couple of people or walk up on a conversation where people are discussing the Federalist Papers or the Anti-Federalist Papers or the 5,000-year leap or discussing the Constitution itself. And whenever I hear the opposition attack the Tea Party, it seems to be rather short on facts. Are you, as a historian, encouraged by the number of people that are now picking up the Constitution, picking up the Federalist Papers, going back and reading the notes from the Constitutional Convention? I mean, it's almost like this world that you've enjoyed is now being shared with a large number of people.
You know, that's exactly right. It has been exciting to see people want to know about the Constitution and want to know about what was it that led to creating this incredible nation, the United States. And I think there is a real hunger for people to celebrate the greatness of America. It doesn't mean that our founding was done in perfection. It certainly absolutely was not. But the principles that our rights are not given by a king, they're not given by a ruler, but they are given by a creator, by a God, and they are inalienable, they are intrinsic, that the human life has value and that government should not intrude upon those natural rights. Those are really exciting things for people to reconnect to, and it's important for people to reconnect to it. You know, we traded royalty for representation. We said goodbye to long live the king or God save the king, and instead we decided to embrace this concept called we the people of the United States of America. And it is exciting to see people looking at our nation's founding and our nation's heritage and seeing what those original principles were and how they were borne out. And what I love about the U.S. Constitution is that the U.S. Constitution is the most tangible proof that the American Revolution was not just a war, that it was a change in the hearts and minds of the thinking. It was a radical change in the way people thought about government, and that is why it was a revolution. It wasn't a revolution because it was a war. It was a revolution because it was a way, it was the way people changed their thinking about government, and that's what's really exciting about seeing people connecting and reading and learning and digging.
I think you argued in your book that the actual revolution started well before the war.
Yes. Yes, it did. John Adams is the one who asked that question, you know, what do we mean by the American Revolution? Do we mean the war? And he answered his own question by saying, no, it was a change in the hearts and minds of people. And I wondered, I thought about that quote by John Adams, and I thought, when did it start? When did that change in thinking start in John Adams' mind? When did it start in George Washington's mind, then Franklin? And that was one question I tried to answer throughout my book, Stories of Faith and Courage from the Revolutionary War, was to realize when did that seed of change begin to think, or change, seed of change began in the mind of, you know, someone like Washington. And I realized it happened differently for different people over time, that certain abuses by the king sparked that change of thinking that, hey, something's not quite right here. You know, George Washington saw a lot of inequality when he was fighting with the British Redcoats when he was a young soldier at age 22. And on that battlefield where he had his near-death experience, he also saw that the British Redcoats panicked and they abandoned their Virginian brethren in arms. And that really bothered Washington. I mean, he wasn't ready to go take up arms against the king the next day, but it really planted a lot of doubt in his mind about how England really viewed America. So it was a progression. It didn't just start at Lexington and Concord. It started years earlier in the minds of many people.
When you made reference to the Constitution a couple minutes ago, you admitted it up front that there certainly was a lack of perfection there. And as we see the Tea Party movement, the conservative movement, more closely embracing the Constitution, there seems to be this all-out attack by the left on the Constitution itself, as it's just another document in a long history of documents in the United States. Rahm Emanuel said it was overrated, and we have everyone from Chris Matthews to the heads of history departments at major universities saying, yeah, the Constitution, it valued African Americans as being three-fifths of a person. The Founding Fathers, when they wrote the Constitution, couldn't possibly imagine our society today, the size to which America would grow, or for that matter, the fact that we would eventually have universal suffrage. So it certainly has its importance, its important place in history, but it's not some perfect document, some perfect infallible document, the way the right likes to hold it up as being.
Well, I think that you've got to look at the principles behind the Constitution, and that's what's really stands the test of time. You know, the Constitution itself, I mean, it has stood the test of time. And we have, over time, we've dealt with the issue of slavery, and we recognize that what a lot of our founders recognized, that you can't say that all are endowed by a creator with inalienable rights and not apply that fully. And so I think that really in some ways the Civil War was the second American Revolution because it completed that change of thinking, the abolitionist movement. And so I think we ought to celebrate those things, that we ought to celebrate the principles and the foundation that the Constitution has given us, and celebrate those times in our history when, you know, we have perfected our union in that respect. And not downplay it. That's what's amazing to me, is there's not a need to tear apart things in the past. I mean, we can recognize those things, but we ought to celebrate as Americans the greatness of those principles and of the people that have come along, like Abraham Lincoln and others who have helped make America what it, the union that it really is today.
As someone who's spent a lot of time going back to these original sources, as you've called them, I'd like your help in shedding some light on the debate that's currently going on about the Three-Fifths Clause. That seems to be the most frequently heard attack by the left on the Constitution, is that it only valued African Americans as being three-fifths of a person. Now, conservatives like to say that the Three-Fifths Clause was put in as a matter of limiting the power of the slave states, where the left will tell you, no, that's just because the Founding Fathers didn't think very much of slaves. And as someone who's gone over a lot of these original documents, why do you think the Three-Fifths Clause was put into the Constitution?
Well, they were really, let me back up to the First Continental Congress. John Adams went to the very First Continental Congress with a mission. He recognized that all of the abuses that the king had imposed on Massachusetts, that if it could happen in Massachusetts, it could happen in Virginia, it could happen in South Carolina. He had a Southern strategy in going into that First Continental Congress, and that was to convince the Southerners to understand what was really going on in Massachusetts and that they had lost their right to assemble and to have a jury trial and many, many other things. And so the whole focus, and this is where what we forget about the founding of our country, the 13 colonies thought of themselves as almost 13 different countries under the umbrella of England. And their mission was to unite as much as they could. Union was the underscoring mission. And so to that end, they compromised on some things to preserve that union because they couldn't fully get everything that they wanted when it came to the Constitution. Not everybody could get everything that they wanted. And I think that's why they ended up with the Three-Fifths Clause. It was a compromise position because, bottom line, they knew they had to stick together and they had to bring some form of union in order to form the United States of America. And over time, you know, that issue got worked out, and it would have been wonderful if it could have been worked out at the beginning, but it wasn't. But again, that was what Lincoln focused on, was union, trying to keep the union together, and that's why he didn't just let the South go and secede and go on their merry way, because he really believed in the United States.
Recently, there was a real brouhaha that developed between Michelle Bachmann and Chris Matthews over at MSNBC because Michelle Bachmann had said that many of our founding fathers were, in fact, against slavery and did some things to sort of lay the groundwork for the eventual freeing of the slaves. And Chris Matthews decided to build up a straw man and say that Michelle Bachmann's so stupid she doesn't even know that slavery ended with the Civil War. She thinks it ended with the founding fathers. Were there, and again, going back to your knowledge and your studying of the original documents and a lot of these original letters and notes, was there in fact a good portion of our founding fathers who were in fact against slavery?
Well, certainly John Adams was very against it, and Jefferson and Franklin talked about putting a clause in the Declaration of Independence about slavery. But again, they knew at that time that they could not get some of the other southern states behind it if they included that clause. George Washington freed his slaves upon his death, and that was a huge sign and signal that set an example for others to follow. And, you know, David Barton is much more knowledgeable about this particular subject than I am, but there's growing evidence to show that the first 20, 30 years of our country, there was a lot more movement toward abolishing slavery, and then we got sidetracked as our country began to grow out west, and that's when things got kind of off kilter before they kind of fully finished the job with after the Civil War as far as slavery was concerned. And I know I've read a lot about John Quincy Adams because I've been writing a manuscript about a book about him, and he also, the son of John Adams, was very ardently against slavery, and it used to frustrate them because they had a domestic, an African of African-American descent who worked for them, and people used to think that he was their slave, and they over and over again were correcting people, no, we pay him. He's a domestic a servant. So it was an issue that I think when we pit people against each other and fail to really look at what happened, it really doesn't do our country good. It does us a disservice. And so I think it's an issue that we ought to take great care in looking at and not be broad brushing like you sometimes see the mainstream media doing. It deserves, better look than that.
Well, speaking of the mainstream media, you've led me right into my next question. Some have referred to 2008 as the year that journalism died. We have others, including myself, who've come out and said that it was the year that journalists dropped all pretense of objectivity to get behind the Barack Obama campaign. And I think it's also arguable that we saw with the attacks on Sarah Palin a concerted effort on the part of the mainstream media to destroy a candidate. What are your thoughts looking back to the 2008 election as far as just how biased the mainstream media was?
Well, I think that what they could have certainly done a better job at was asking the candidates where they really stood on the issues. That was what was really not well vetted. I think, Barack Obama presented a very charismatic, a very optimistic message, but he really wasn't asked to explain the policies in detail that would support that overarching hope and change message. And I think that's where the media didn't do their job. They did not ask him tough questions. Well, how are you going to do this? And how are you going to do that? And I think what happened is we ended up with a celebrity president. We had people who genuinely and understandably were attracted to that message because that is a great message. But what happened is you had someone who was boosting himself and that government was going to be the solution to everything, whereas what the people really need is a candidate who will talk about the greatness of America and the importance and value of individual liberty, and the individuals are ultimately the solution to a failing economy, and to pump up the greatness of individuals, of America as a whole, and individuals to make that whole great. I think people are really, really hungry for a candidate who will talk about the greatness of America, not the greatness of themselves or the greatness of a government. And I just really sense that that's what people deep down really want to hear. And we've had presidents in the past who've been that way.
I was both amused and disappointed when we had what could have been a very special moment on Fox News. They had Sarah Palin and Geraldine Ferraro sitting beside each other in studio. Sarah Palin, much the lady, not taking any political swipes at the left. Can't say that Geraldine Ferraro paid her the same respect or courtesy, but as they talked about the attacks on Sarah Palin during the 2008 election, Geraldine Ferraro said, "Oh, I got that too. I got that too." And the first thought that went through my mind was, excuse me, Mrs. Ferraro, Saturday Night Live never did a skit suggesting that your husband had incest with your children. David Letterman never suggested that you were perfecting a slutty stewardess look. And David Letterman certainly never joked about your daughter becoming pregnant while having intercourse at Yankee Stadium in the middle of a game. So I think the level of attack was much more intense on Sarah Palin than it ever was on Geraldine Ferraro. What's your take on just how nasty the media, and by media I don't just mean the news media, but the entertainment industry as well. What's your take on just how nasty these people were towards Sarah Palin?
Well, they definitely went way too far and over the top in their parodies of her. And, I think at one point it was difficult to discern because she was new on the scene and on the national scene. It was really difficult to discern fact from fiction. Certainly the things you just named were highly fiction. But there's that blurry middle of, okay, well, what's if you're not paying close attention, it was, I think, very confusing. And I think it does our system a disservice when people go too far. I think what's interesting is that Sarah Palin has come on the scene and she's you know, a lot of times women in the past who've been in public eye and have run for public office, a lot of times they I think run away a little bit from their femininity. And, you know, Sarah Palin has long hair. She's fully embraced her motherhood, you know, publicly. And that's, I think people aren't, they've never seen that before. Because a lot of, not, I shouldn't say never, but a lot of women who've been in public office, they shy away from talking about their family. Or they've shied away from, you know, more traditional roles that women have had. And I think... and I think in that way, Sarah Palin's been a very refreshing change because she's just been who she is. And I think bottom line, Americans want you, male or female, to be who you are. They want that authenticity. And unfortunately, our media and entertainment industry doesn't always know how to deal with that kind of authenticity.
Did you find it a little amusing that the left, that has long proclaimed itself to be a champion of women's rights, was asking questions like, you know, how's she going to raise that many kids and serve in public office? And how much does she pay for those shoes? How much does she pay for those clothes? I would think in the past, if anybody had asked such questions about a Democrat, a female Democrat running for office, they would have been up in arms at the sexist nature of that commentary.
Right. You know, there are sometimes is double standard in the media, but that's certainly something that is unfortunate. Interesting, I saw a woman, a Democratic candidate, younger woman for Congress. She didn't win, but I saw her interviewed. And some of the Hillary Clinton people had surrounded her, and they had suggested that she cut her hair, that she wear more business suits, that she looked too feminine. And that bothered her, even though she was a Democratic candidate. She's like, I'm not going to change who I am. And I thought, well, maybe we're beginning to see some pushback in a little younger generation on some of that, some of the ways things have been coming out of the 60s and the feminist movement. Maybe we're seeing some pushback. From both sides.
I hope so. I've always been curious about that. If you take a look at the hairstyle of Janet Reno, of Kagan, of Rachel Maddow, it's almost as if that's the official left-wing hairstyle for some reason, and that there's something wrong with embracing the fact that you're a woman. I don't know why that's considered detrimental to be a woman and to have someone...
Right, and again, I think male and female need to be who they are and be authentic and to let their character and their integrity and their leadership qualities stand out. And that's what bottom line people really want out of their candidates is authenticity. So
you've been around George W. Bush for a long time. You were his webmaster when he was governor of Texas. You were his webmaster for 4 years when he was in the White House. And I have to ask, how much does it make you want to pull your hair out when you hear people saying, well, Bush was president, therefore the economy was 100% Bush's mess? And when you try to bring up the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act and the fact that it also contained measures to make changes to the Community Reinvestment Act, and you try to talk about Fannie and Freddie and Franklin Rains and Acorn and subprime mortgages, the liberals are kind of like, I don't know what you're talking about. It's all Bush's mess. Yet they fail to go back and look at Graham's bill and the wide bipartisan support that it had, the fact that Chuck Schumer himself, you know, uber-liberal Chuck Schumer, actually gave an impassioned plea for people to vote for it on the floor of the Senate. And we even had President William Jefferson Clinton sign this thing into law. It both deregulated Wall Street and provided the tool for Acorn to go on an arm-twisting crusade throughout the banking world to give loans to people who couldn't afford to pay them back. Yet, despite the fact that this was a bipartisan effort in the House and the Senate, and that President Clinton signed this into law, the whole thing is looked at, and let's not forget about the fact that we had a House and a Senate controlled by the Democrats the last 2 years of the Bush presidency. The entire thing, as far as liberals are concerned, is Bush's fault because Bush was the president. As someone who knows the facts, how frustrating is that to you, especially as someone so close to the Bush presidency?
Well, you know, one thing that I admire about Bush is that he sees all of that too, and he is confident in what he did as president and that he made the absolute best decisions that he could along the way, and he is confident that history in the long run will bear out what it should bear out. And so I think he really is that he has, and I couldn't do this if I were in his position, he can blow it off and look at what he knows to be the truth. And that's an amazing quality. And, you know, there were times I wish that he had defended himself more on certain issues. But that's an amazing quality to be able to say, you know, I know as things unraveled or as things unfolded and as I was faced with different decision-making, I did the absolute best that I could. And I can live in my own skin because I know that. And I think that that's what I do admire about him. And it's interesting. People really didn't like Harry Truman when he was president. I mean, that's why they thought Dewey had won the election. And there was just this people, there was kind of this attitude about Truman, and he pulled off that election. But he didn't have a successful presidency, so it seemed at the time. And then you look, you know, historians begin to look back, and they begin to really examine Truman and everything, and I'm not a Truman expert, but they saw his presidency differently. And I think Bush knows that about presidents, that happens often. And so I think he's comfortable in his own skin about a lot of the decisions that he made, which is why I think he wrote the autobiography called Decision Points, because that's how he focused his presidency, was he really focused on the decision-making aspect of being president.
Let's fast forward to recent events. Horowitz once warned us that there was an unholy alliance between the left and Islamic extremism, and now we're watching events unfold in the Middle East. We have people on the left who are perfectly comfortable with the Muslim Brotherhood taking over Egypt. We have Clapper yesterday suggesting that the Muslim Brotherhood was pretty much a secular organization. And I'm sorry, I can't say that one without laughing. And we hear the stories of Bill Ayers and Code Pink being involved over there. Are we seeing overt proof that there is an unholy alliance between the American left and Islamic extremism?
Well, I'm not sure I can really answer that question fully because I just don't know. But you've got and this kind of goes back to what we were talking about a minute ago, and our leadership and our media need to really look at what America's best interest is, period. And the best interest of the United States is to have allies who are committed to the principles of individual liberty and freedom. And we don't have that fully at all. I mean, and I think you've pointed out examples where we're not seeing that. That's what we really, really need, especially when we're in a time of war. And I don't have an answer for any of that, but that's why I think we do need leadership that can point to the greatness of America and look at those founding principles and work toward finding those dissidents and those elements in places like Egypt where there really is a hunger for democracy and liberty. And I think perhaps the failing of our government, and I don't know because I'm not an expert on Egypt and relationships with Egypt, is that we perhaps haven't looked enough at the dissidents that are there that are looking for that, because we're seeing only the other. And maybe they're there, maybe they're not. But I'll tell you a story about Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan spoke loudly and boldly against Soviet aggression. We heard the Evil Empire speech. We heard him outline his Strategic Defense Initiative. This was all March 1983. But you know what we didn't know about Reagan in 1983? At that same time, he was negotiating with the Soviets behind the scenes to release some religious dissidents who had stormed the U.S. Embassy 5 years earlier and had refused to leave until they got a visa to go to Israel. And they had been stuck in the embassy for 5 years. Reagan was quietly negotiating with the Soviets. He said, "Hey, if you will do something if you will do something about these religious dissidents and free them, that will show us that you are willing to start talking." And they went back and forth, and they were released. And the agreement that Reagan made was, "Hey, I'm not going to crow or brag about it if they're released." and they were. They went to both Israel, some of them, and then some of them came to the United States, and I interviewed one of them a few weeks ago for Reagan's 100th. And so we need, you know, leadership that can focus on the elements in other countries that are pro-freedom and pro-liberty and stand up for them behind the scenes. And that's what we, I think, need in places like Egypt in particular.
The other thing about Reagan that I guess you could contrast with current leadership is that he didn't really care if other countries liked him. He wanted them to respect him and, more importantly, to respect the United States. But he wasn't trying to win a popularity contest around the world. He certainly wouldn't have bowed to foreign leaders the way Barack Obama has done. And I think, you know, many would argue that this olive branch tour that Barack Obama has gone on really hasn't yielded any positive results.
Well, Reagan, and I read through a lot of his speeches that he made on foreign soil, and he had there was a common denominator in his speeches on foreign soil. He almost always spoke proudly, humbly, but beautifully about the American people, the American dream, and the principles that America stood for. It wasn't all about him. He was excited, even giddy, on his first trip to Europe. I think it was 1982, because he was delayed because of his assassination attempt on his life in 81. But he was giddy about going to represent the United States. And you're right, it wasn't about him and caring whether foreign leaders liked him or not. He was so enthusiastic about who he represented and what he represented that that's what carried through. And I think that is what, again, I think we need that in a leader. You know, and the sad thing about Barack Obama is that here is someone who came into to office with a lot of votes behind him. He came into office with a lot of world attention on him. And just think what he could have done if he had gone to these different countries and really, really talked about the greatness of the United States. What a difference that could have made for our country. And that's putting aside politics. You know, that was a missed opportunity. And not going to get into his motivation because I can't really speak to that, but that's what I think Americans are really, really hungry for. And I think that's why you see people in the Tea Party movement going back to, hey, what was that Constitutional Convention all about? What were the Federalist Papers? Why were we founded as a nation? What does all of this really mean? And what did it mean then? And what does it mean now? I think people are really hungry for connecting with the original principles of our country.
There are comparisons being drawn between Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama in terms of their popularity at this early point in the presidency, 2 years in. Parallels being drawn with the economy and a turnaround in the economy allowing Reagan to be reelected. We have seen some positive signs in the economy recently in terms of the unemployment rate. Some people would argue that that's a number that's not very reliable because it's more reflective of the number of people who are giving up and dropping out of the system and not looking for work than it is a reflection of jobs created. But nevertheless, it's being touted as proof that Obama's stimulus worked and that Obama's turning the economy around. If we continue to see a drop in unemployment, and by that I think if he even got it back down to where it was whenever he took office, do you see Obama having a strong chance at reelection in 2012?
Well, I think all of that will come down to really the dynamics of who the candidate opposing him is and their strengths and what the policy implications are and what the issues are. I mean, I certainly think that Barack Obama, you know, he is a gifted, charismatic fellow, and he has, you know, some very charismatic qualities, but I think the difference is emphasis. He has emphasized a government solution, and, you know, Reagan, in 1982, people weren't real happy with him. I mean, his numbers were dropping. I looked at some of those numbers. He was in the 40% range at the midterms. Unemployment had gotten higher the first 18 months, 2 years into his presidency. It had not dropped, but he had his economic policy was really focused on giving money back to people and cutting those tax rates and the percentages that people were paying in taxes, and that when you gave more money back to the people, they would have money to invest in small businesses. The stimulus has been so focused on the government spending money that it hasn't really driven the individual, entrepreneurial, small business aspect of it. And I just think the results are going to, in the long term, are going to be different. The economy, you know, unemployment may be ticking down a little bit for maybe some of the reasons that you're saying. But I think if people don't sense that there's really something in it for them, then that will show up in their vote in 2012. So I can't say whether he'll be reelected or not. I think there are a lot of factors that will go into it. But again, I think people are, they want that hope and change, but I think they want to hear it from someone who recognizes the individual liberty aspect of America, and he emphasizes that. And I think the candidate that can do that has a really good shot.
Let's talk about two of your other books in the 5 or 6 minutes that we have left. Talk to us about The Faith of America's First Ladies.
Well, The Faith of America's First Ladies takes a look at some of the really fine women who have served as our nation's first ladies. It looks at an Old Testament proverb about a woman who is married to a judge, and the poem in this proverb, Proverbs 31, is about a woman of character, a woman who can laugh at the days to come. And so I used Barbara Bush as a good story to explain that verse. Someone who could work with eager hands, and I used Abigail Adams' work ethic to bring that concept of working hard to life. So that's what the book does, is it looks at these beautiful principles of womanhood and uses stories of first ladies to bring that to life. So it's a great womanhood book. It's great for Mother's Day, Valentine's Day, all sorts of things, because it's just a really great gal's book in that way.
For liberals who might be listening, do you have anything in there about Hillary Clinton's ability to channel Eleanor Roosevelt?
No, but, you know, it's not a partisan book. I mean, I do mention Mrs. Clinton, and I do, you know, I try to be very even-handed and nonpartisan about the book, because I think that's an important thing to do when you're writing a book on that topic. It's not a political book that way.
I see. Now, you were about to mention B is for Baylor.
Right. I do have a couple of children's books out. One is called B is for Baylor. I went to Baylor University and was asked to write a lovely alphabet book about that university, which was a lot of fun to do. And it's a great, it's really a good book, though. It's about Baylor, but it's also about education. And I think it's important to plant that vision of getting an education in the minds of children, that the hope and the idea of, hey, I can learn and grow and become a doctor or become an attorney or become a teacher. I think it's important to do that. And B is for Baylor is a book that definitely talks about that. And then I have another children's book that's brand new called What Does the President Look Like? And this is a great presidential history book, but it asks the question, you know, how did they know what George Washington looked like? And how did they know what Lincoln looked like? It looks at that question and reveals, hey, our technology changed. Paintings enabled us to know about Washington. Political cartoons and newspapers that cost only a penny allowed us to know about Andrew Jackson, and then photography and Lincoln. And it really connects the dots, and I think hopefully will help kids who live in this digital wonderland kind of understand how we got here. And it uses the president to show them how we did get here.
And tell the listeners how they can purchase these books.
Oh, these are all available. Faith of America's First Lady, Stories of Faith and Courage from the Revolutionary War, What Does the President Look Like? All of them are available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. Your major bookstores can, usually they have them in stock, and if they don't, they can certainly get them for you.
We do have the ability to post links to Amazon.com on Blog Talk Radio, and I think we've already arranged for Battlefields and Blessings and The Faith of America's First Ladies and B is for Baylor to be on there, but we'll add What Does the President Look Like and several of your other works as well, so that while people are listening to this, all they have to do is scroll down to the bottom of the page, and they'll see a copy of at least one of the books, and there'll be some arrows there, and you can use those arrows to toggle back and forth between the various books, and if you see one or more that you would like to purchase, All you have to do is click on it, where you will be transported immediately to Amazon.com, and you'll be able to order the book. Or if you can't wait, run down to Barnes & Noble and get a copy there. Now, you also, I'm guessing, would give a lot of presentations and speeches throughout the year. How would someone go about contacting you if they were interested in having you speak to their group?
Oh, well, you can go to my website, janecook.com, and there's a way to send me an email. You know, and I also have someone who helps me sometimes coordinate events. But I do love to talk about our nation's history, and I really hope to try to bring it to life. Ben Franklin said, if you would not be forgotten as soon as you are dead and rotten, either write the things worth reading or do the things worth the writing. And I hope, you know, I try to write about people who have done the things worth the writing, and that's really been my thrust and focus since I left the White House, was to just bring history to life in a way that's real and relevant.
Well, from what I've read of Battlefields and Blessings, you've certainly done it to this particular book. I have found it a very enjoyable read. I like the way you have it broken down into 365 stories with a prayer and a Bible quote attached to each. I just think it's a wonderful way to do it. And there's nothing, you have a considerable number of excerpts from letters and notes from people who fought in the Revolutionary War, and it really, really brings it to life in terms of the hardships that they were going through, the sacrifices they made in their lives, how they put their lives on hold for this. And I just want to congratulate you. You definitely have brought it to life, this particular book, and I'm sure in the rest of your books as well. Jane, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for being here today. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to appeal to you to write a book called A is for Aggie, since we both attended that university.
I'm happy to do that.
And we look forward to having you back again sometime soon.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you for being here.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.